We have a major announcement. This follows in lockstep with our commitment to eliminate the tyranny of Saddam Hussein and expeditiously transform Iraq into a modern, functioning democracy. Ambassador Bremer has just signed an order immediately disbanding Iraq's remaining military forces.
What you're hearing there is the sound of a movie clip of an alleged real news conference that took place in the unreal Green Zone way back in 2003. Since the fall of Saddam Hussein, I think most Americans, it's fair to say, understand the Green Zone to be the unofficial capital of the U.S. occupation.
Yeah, right. What's the home base of the Ba'ath Party?
Indeed. And the movie, though, Green Zone, is ancient history, really, if
yeah.
we think about what's
yeah,
changed since then, that's for sure. The Green Zone, a city within a city, an isolation bubble within a nation. As U.S. troops prepare to end their combat mission there, the Green Zone is really on the leading edge of the transition from Saddam Hussein to U.S. occupation and back to some form of Iraqi self-government. Anthony Shadid joins us, foreign correspondent for the New York Times, based in Baghdad. He won the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting this year for his coverage of the Iraq War. He joins us from Najaf, the Iraqi city to the south of Baghdad. Good morning, Anthony Shadid.
Good morning.
And Hugh Sykes is also with us, BBC correspondent in Baghdad, who reminded us that the Green Zone is a fully Iraqi institution at this point. Anthony Shadid, can you describe the arc of change from what the Green Zone was understood to be as a territory of Baghdad by Iraqis under Saddam Hussein, how it changed, and what it's changing back to?
You know, I think the Green Zone, what's remarkable about it is that it's always represented power in Baghdad, all the way back to the end of the monarchy in 1958. You had government offices there, you had presidents, prime ministers serving there. So it's always been kind of a preserve within Baghdad where rulers often lived and worked. What I think was remarkable after 2003, after the fall of Saddam, is how much it became associated with the American occupation, with the American headquarters, a city within a city, as you pointed out. You know, these days it is, as my colleague pointed out, it is an Iraqi zone. There's the American embassy still there. There's American soldiers and an American base there. But for all intents and purposes, it really is an Iraqi zone, but it still represents the same notion that we've always understood it as, and that is the seat of power.
Anthony Shadid, foreign correspondent for the New York Times, speaking from Najaf, Iraq. Hugh Sykes, would you go along with that? And if the Green Zone is an Iraqi institution now, what do people in Baghdad think of this place? Is it a border? Is it a checkpoint that they move across? Is it a scary place? Is it just a place where the annoying government spends its time?
All those things.
Really?
Annoying government. If only there was an annoying government.
Right. Yeah,
there were elections in March, and there is no damned annoying government after more than 5 months. No, the Green Zone is a place which is the IZ, the International Zone is its correct name, a place which is deeply resented by very large numbers of Iraqis because it is this enclave within which not only the Americans with their opulent kind of holiday resort-style embassy with all mod cons and air conditioning and pools and cafes and lovely buildings and razor wire and watchtowers and the British Embassy with its infinity swimming pool and its pub, improbably, madly named the Incoming. Have we got that? Incoming missiles?
Oh,
they call a pub that?
Oh,
how crass
detail.
Is that? You also have ministers, Iraqi ministers living inside the Green Zone. You also have some of the Iraqi ministries inside the Green Zone. The Americans, the British, these ministers all have their own private security. The outer perimeter is guarded by the Iraqi army. And the resentment comes because within this bubble, all these people have a luxurious life, which is frankly totally cut off from the real world outside, which is known as the Red Zone, red for danger. They never have power cuts in the Green Zone. They've got generators with unlimited supplies of diesel. Out here in Baghdad, in the real world, where our bureau is, for example, our generator is on, I would estimate now, 20 out of 24 hours every day, and that is typical for most of the people in this city, which is an abject failure of the occupying powers here, who very early on in 2003, an American military engineer said to me, we're going to get the power back up and running here in Baghdad in 48 hours. Not 48 hours, not 48 days, not 48 weeks, not 48 months. They still haven't managed. They've failed totally to provide the most basic requirement of civilized life, and they're leaving the country before they've done it.
Anthony, you know, as Hugh was referring to, the Green Zone got its name as a military designation that contrasted it with the unsafe red zones. What do the Iraqi people call it?
You know, that's a funny thing. In fact, they've actually adopted the name Green Zone, and they'll say it in Arabic. And there's it's often a source of confusion because there's a neighborhood that also has the name Green. And some Iraqis will say, are you referring to our green or their green? We're trying to designate whether it's the Green Zone or the neighborhood itself. It's one of these terms, these American terms, that are going to enter into the Iraqi language. They'll probably be here for another generation or so.
Does anyone use Emerald City, as you used famously in your book, Anthony?
You know, it was actually my colleague's book, and you really don't hear it here, though. Emerald City is kind of, it's probably almost too American for Iraqis to see it as such.
Metaphors aside, how important is it, and Hugh sort of describes the difficulties in Baghdad outside of the Green Zone, how important is it for Iraqi sovereignty that the Green Zone go away in some sense? Anthony?
Well, you know, you wonder if it ever will go away. I mean, because it is the seat of, or supposedly seat of government. As you pointed out, there is no government right now. But it is the seat of power, the seat of government. So it probably always will be disconnected. But as you pointed out, I think it's a great point. There is an incredible amount of resentment about the seclusion of the Green Zone, about this divorce between rulers and rule, the sense that the elite in this country really have no idea about the everyday hardships that Iraqis are going through, electricity being one of them, water being another, unemployment, just a really kind of shoddy level of basic services.
Well, speaking to us on the first day of Ramadan, Anthony Shadid, foreign correspondent for the New York Times, Pulitzer Prize winner based in Baghdad, talking about the Green Zone. He's on the phone from Najaf, Iraq. Before we go, Hugh Sykes, what can you get besides the beer at the incoming pub there at the British Embassy? What can you get in the Green Zone that you could get nowhere else in Baghdad or Iraq, for that matter, Hugh Sykes?
Safety, mostly, except that people fire rockets at the Green Zone quite often. There was one fired at the Green Zone yesterday, and we've no idea what it hit, who it hit, what damage it caused. There's a kind of an empty hole, a black hole of information. When things go into the Green Zone, rockets or mortars, we hardly ever hear from anybody what they hit or who they hit or what the damage was. But it's a kind of safe place, and a lot of people, also part of the resentment out here, is that not only do they have the power in there, I mean the electric power as well as the political power, also many people simply see all the occupants of the Green Zone as cowards.
Right.
How can a diplomat really do his work unless he goes out and walks the streets?
Well, the brave Hugh Sykes has the BBC correspondent in Baghdad at the bureau in outside of the Green Zone. Hugh, is the generator on there?
It certainly is.
Thanks. The generator's on at the BBC Bureau.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.